Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In Massachusetts, the voting is now underway. The names on the ballot are Brown and Coakley, but they might as well be Obama and health care. The stakes are high and the rhetoric is white hot.
I know I'm not Ted Kennedy. Nobody is.
Just run a positive, healthy, upbeat, straightforward, issues-oriented campaign. And that's what I've done.
He's totally wrong. Just because you're driving a truck around Massachusetts doesn't mean you're going in the right direction.
You can criticize my record. You can talk about the positions I have. But don't ever start criticizing my truck.
Could the Democrats' agenda really all end with the election to succeed the late Ted Kennedy? Irony you can't make up on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning to you. It's Tuesday, January 19th. I'm Miles O'Brien in New York for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week. I'm joined by John Hockenberry in Washington. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Miles. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. A week after the earth shook in Haiti, the numbers coming in are staggering. The European Commission now estimates there are 200,000 dead and another 1.5 million homeless. That makes the catastrophe about as deadly as the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami. 90% of the survivors in Port-au-Prince are still sleeping in the streets.
We don't have no houses. Most of the houses destroyed. Even the houses stand up, people scared to sleep on them.
For that reason, among others, thousands are now fleeing the city. Earlier, we spoke to Carol Stern, the CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, about the pace of aid into the country.
It may feel slow. It is slow. We wish it were quicker, but it is more than likely as fast as it possibly could have been.
Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, meanwhile, told us this morning that her department is playing an important role on the ground.
HHS has one of the leads in the public health response, and also our Centers for Disease Control personnel are on the ground helping to secure and look at the safe water and food supplies.
The aid is flowing in, but Haitian singer Wyclef Jean has this reminder.
For every success story you see, there's another 40,000 that's been buried.
So far, U.S. donations for Haiti have passed $200 million.
Here at home, the polls are now open in the special Senate election in Massachusetts. It's a too close to call race between Democrat Martha Coakley and Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. Joining us once again, Jared Bowen, a reporter for the Greater Boston and our partner station WGBH. Jared, earlier this morning, you were with us at the Cathedral High School in Boston's South End neighborhood. It seemed as if turnout was going to be high. Is that still the case?
It is. I think everybody's trying to get out before work, and also we're in the midst of a snowstorm, so I think that has probably changed things dramatically. People were certainly lined up a lot stronger than I even anticipated. That's even with the Secretary of the Commonwealth's forecast within the past few days that the turnout was going to be high based on just absentee ballots. But now with the snowstorm, it remains to be seen how the vote is going to turn out for the rest of the day.
What is the conventional wisdom about how turnout favors one candidate or the other?
Well, I think, especially with the snowstorm, it's easier for people in the city to vote, and that's going to help Martha Coakley. She really needs to get out the vote here in Suffolk County, which is the Boston area. And, of course, the Democrats have had a really powerful machine here in Massachusetts for a very long time, of course, orchestrated in large part by Senator Kennedy. This is Scott Brown's first major campaign, and the Republicans have been weak in Massachusetts for several years, although you certainly wouldn't see that from the last week and what they've been able to pull together.
Thanks very much. Jared Bowen, reporter for the Greater Boston, our partner station WGBH carries that. We'll talk more about that election in just a moment. John.
A couple of economic stories. Japan Airlines files for bankruptcy. Citigroup announced its second consecutive yearly loss. The bank lost $1.5 billion in 2009. Asian markets were mixed. European indices are down. Wall Street futures are mixed. The Dow will get underway at 10,609. The S&P opens at 1,136 in about a half an hour, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,287. We're interested in the media's coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti. We're going to talk about it later. But what do you think of the language of that coverage? When is looting appropriate or simply survival? 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
I'm Miles O'Brien, in for Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckaberry down here in Washington, D.C., here with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. And this town, Todd, myself, Miles, we're all watching that same political drama in Massachusetts, aren't we?
Yeah, Tip O'Neill said all politics is local. Maybe not in this case. Listen to this.
We will continue the tremendous work of Ted Kennedy. I know I'm not Ted Kennedy. Nobody is. But we are certainly not sending Scott Brown down in that seat.
Right. That's Democrat Martha Coakley. Massachusetts voters head to the polls today to vote for the senator who will fill Ted Kennedy's seat. And their vote for either Democratic candidate Martha Coakley or Republican Scott Brown could make or break the passage of Kennedy's dream, health care legislation. David Bernstein is a political reporter and columnist at the Boston Phoenix. His column is called Talking Politics. And also, as previously mentioned by John, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. David, let's begin with you. This is an awfully close race. How did this get so close, and what's the thinking today with the prospect of heavy turnout?
Well, it does look like it's going to be quite heavy turnout. The initial things that I'm hearing are that people are showing up even though the weather is not expected to be too great today across the state. But it got this way because this is not as heavily Democratic a state as a lot of people assume, and the backlash against both the national Democrats and the statewide Democrats has left a lot of people in sort of a grumpy mood, if you will. And I think this has been less about specific issues than just trying to send the message about government responsiveness, and the Democrats really just didn't see it coming. They took this general election for granted and let this all sneak up on them. And as a result, the Republican, Scott Brown, has been able to define the race to his advantage.
Is that the story of this election, that Democrats took it for granted, or is this truly a litmus test that Massachusetts voters are sort of relishing, giving the entire country?
Well, I think it's a combination of the two. I think that that there's no question that Democratic voters here in the state are sending a message. And again, it has a lot to do with what's happening here in the state, which is also, you know, any problems here in the state are blamed on the Democrats who are in control of government. And at the national level, the same is true. So that's there. And the Democrats, in turn, have taken for granted their ability to win races like this and have not realized that they need to frame this election and other elections this year in those terms. They need to combat that problem in a straightforward, aggressive manner, rather than trying to respond after the Republican defines the race to that advantage.
All right. Let's bring Todd into this now. Todd Zwillick in Washington, sitting beside John there. If the Democrats lose this seat today, that makes them not filibuster proof anymore, and that in essence ends health care legislation in the Senate. What's the plan B for Democrats? Is there a plan B?
Good morning, Miles. It doesn't necessarily end health care legislation in the Senate. There could be some legislative sleight of hand, and of course, as we've talked about earlier this week, it's also going to depend on if Scott Brown wins, when he's actually sworn in. They have 60 until he's sworn in, so you can digest that and digest some potential delay tactics.
But imagine the hue and cry if they tried to sneak the vote in this kind of, you know, almost like a recess appointment kind of thing.
But imagine the Democratic tragedy if health care fails. The downside of losing Barack Obama's number one agenda item is way worse than the hue and cry on Fox News.
Know. Railroading health care reform by delaying the swearing in, that could end up killing Obama in 2012.
I'm not saying it would be good, John, but having his number one agenda item fail is way worse quicker, I think.
What about the midterm elections, much less 2012? This is going to have a lot of impact there as well.
It's true. 2010 is a big deal, but in the Senate, you know, this idea of 60, it's important. And if Martha Coakley loses this race, it will be a major political defeat for Barack Obama. There's no question about it. But this idea that going from 60 to 59 debilitates Obama's agenda in the Senate is really not true. And just very quickly, look at global warming. Look at immigration. Look at a Wall Street crackdown, regulatory reform. These are all the big things the Democrats say they want to do this year. The big hard stuff, not the little stuff. You know, immigration, the big stuff. Miles, there's not 60 votes for any of these things now. Democrats are not voting in unison. The last time they tried immigration, it failed It failed to get 60. It failed by 14 votes. And the dynamics haven't changed all that much. There are moderate to conservative Democrats across the Midwest, Democrats who are not voting for a global warming bill as it is now. So going from 60 to 59, while it is a major political defeat, it's not like it debilitates Obama's agenda. His agenda in the Senate was never that strong to begin with.
David, let's talk about Massachusetts voters. I think those of us on the outside are looking at this thinking they're thinking about health care and the Obama first year. Is that really what's on their mind today?
Well, I think that that is a big piece of it. But I think that John is right in a lot of ways about the difficulties that the national Democrats face. And it's on health care and it's on other issues. But it's playing out here in Massachusetts where the folks who are on the right, center to right, it's very easy for them to be against whatever the Democrats are doing. But on the left, the base on the left is not in lockstep happy with what's happening in Washington. Many of
Are you talking about because of all the compromises in health care legislation?
Well, it's on both sides. You've got a lot of progressives who are exactly right. They're unhappy with the compromises that have been made on health care in specific, but also on some other things, slow movement on some gay rights issues, on Guantanamo Bay and so forth. But then you've also got more centrist Democrats here in the Bay State who think that Washington is too liberal. So when you're in power, it's easy to be split on your side because you're actually doing things, whereas the base on the other side are much more united in their opposition.
Todd, just briefly as we go away here, I know the president finally set the date for the State of the Union next Wednesday. I think he was hoping to have this sort of wrapped up beforehand. What's he going to say?
Well, I don't know what he's going to say, but I can tell you this. If Martha Coakley and the Democrats lose this race, they're going to rewrite that speech. It's going to be a very different message to the American people and to Congress if he's repudiated than it would have been than the speech they thought they were going to give 3 weeks ago.
All right. Safe to say that. David Bernstein, who is a reporter with the Boston Phoenix, Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks. Let's check the stories we're following at 15 minutes past the hour.
Well, Miles, in Haiti, the United Nations is defending its earthquake relief effort. A spokeswoman says coordination on the ground is now working well. She also paid tribute to the U.S. relief effort, saying the airport in Port-au-Prince would not be working at all without U.S. assistance. Meanwhile, aid to quake victims is slowly increasing, though relief workers say pockets of violence in the capital are an obstacle. Rear Admiral Mike Rogers of the Joint Task Force in Haiti says security problems are isolated.
We have seen nothing that suggests to us that we have widespread disorder, no sense of widespread panic.
An interesting and scary report this morning in the Washington Post. It says the Justice Department is expected to explain how the FBI illegally collected thousands of U.S. telephone records during the Bush administration. Post says the FBI proclaimed non-existent terrorism emergencies to illegally gather phone records. We've been talking about the NBC story this morning. Last night on his show, Jay Leno poked fun at the network drama that would move him out of prime time.
Remember the more innocent days of late night TV when the only thing people cared about was which intern the host was nailing? What happened there?
Leno will likely move back to the 11:35 slot. And finally, the biggest airline in Asia, Japan Airlines, has filed for bankruptcy protection in one of the biggest corporate failures in Japanese history. The government says flights will continue as normal. Shares in Japan Airlines fell to an all-time low, valuing the entire company at roughly the cost of a single new Boeing 747 jet.
I could buy it.
Write him a check.
Maybe.
And that's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, our friend Peter Morrissey tells us about Citigroup's $7.6 billion loss during the final 3 months of 2009. That's in just a few moments.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
So our first news takeout this morning comes from the man himself. There we go. Peter Morici joins us, an economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, to talk about Citigroup announcing its earnings a little over an hour ago. It ended a three-quarter profit streak with a $7.6 billion loss during the final 3 months of 2009. And Peter Morici, I don't know if inviting you on the program is piling on to Citibank or if we're going to actually get to the bottom of this here. Good morning.
Well, it's not hard to get to the bottom of this. I told your listeners a year ago and before that that until you get rid of Vikram Pandit, you're just not going to solve the problems of Citigroup. He still has on the board a man named Armstrong, who was his director of risk management during the great debacle. He doesn't get rid of the managers that caused the mess, and he pays himself nothing. He pays himself a dollar because the government insists on it, which is more than he's worth, by the way.
Vikram Pandit, of course, the CEO of Citibank. Let's talk about his management decisions here.
But, I mean, he's still paying
to pay back. Say it again?
He's still paying huge bonuses over there.
Right. Okay. Well, before we talk about the bonuses for a second, he tried to pay back, or he actually succeeded in paying back the government and the Troubled Asset Relief Program. But do you think that was a good decision, since much of this loss seems to come from the amount of debt he had to acquire to actually pay back the loans?
Well, the New York Times portrays it that way, which is a very sympathetic paper to the administration. I would suggest to you that you can't get around the fact that the losses were made on bad securities that they created and bought and sold, and on bad consumer loans. Portraying it as related to the TARP is rather tricky business in my mind. The bottom line here is that they made bad loans, they're writing them down, it's required to pay off the TARP, but it would have been required anyway. So let's not blame paying off the TARP.
All right, well, let's look at the taxpayers. Say it again?
They don't know how to bank. They make loans get repaid, and they create securities that they go bust.
Got it. All right. Taxpayers still own, by my estimate here, about $7.7 billion in Citigroup shares, stock shares.
Yep.
Now, since the bank has not been restored to profitability in his second year of being in this top job, what's that stock worth?
Well, it's probably still worth quite a bit if we can get in there and deal with Citigroup as we said we would. You know, the government wants resolution authority for future crises to break up groups like Citibank, but it's got control of this one and doesn't break it up, which just goes to show you how hollow Mr. Geithner's promises are and how hollow his financial service reforms are. My feeling is that Citigroup has got very good businesses. For example, it has a payment system that's used around the world that's integrated with its basic banking business. My feeling is that's worth a lot of money. If you just basically cleaned up the bank's bad debts and then sold off the bank, you probably get that for the payment scheme. Unfortunately, it would be likely to go to a foreign bank. You certainly wouldn't want to give it to Goldman Sachs. They would find a way to trade on it and abuse it.
All right, well, let's look at the bonus issue that you raised earlier. This is another thing that puzzles me. Technically, Vikram Pandit, the CEO of Citigroup, has paid back the TARP funds, but because the taxpayers are so, underwater with the stock.
Huge amounts of, wait a minute, he's repaid
why can,
the
how can they still pay bonuses?
There's two kinds of TARP money. There's the borrowed money and there's the investment money. He's repaid the borrowed money. He hasn't even paid the revestment money. That's why we still own shares. Again, he's very good at manipulating, through the New York Times and others, how you understand what he's doing. He lost money not because he repaid back the TARP, but because he made bad loans, and he still has TARP money in his grasp because the government invested directly in the company and used TARP money to do that.
All right. Peter Morici, an economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, and not likely to be an employee anytime soon at Citigroup. Peter Morici, thanks so much.
No bonus for him. Our last takeout comes from you, our listeners. Our coverage of the earthquake in Haiti has sparked responses from listeners on everything from how to help to who should pay. And after our family segment yesterday, we got this from Jeffrey in Lansing, Michigan. He called 877-8-MY-TAKE to say he's surprised teachers don't talk about Haiti in schools.
I asked my young nephew, he's about 12 years old, I imagine you've been talking about the tragedy in Haiti at school. And he said no. And I said, well, you mean not one teacher has brought up what's going on in Haiti right now? And he said no. A couple of kids talk about it in the lunchroom, but that's about it.
Well, it may be a difficult conversation, but if done right, as we spoke about earlier this week, it can encourage kids to direct their anxiety in a positive way. They could raise money in school, selling cookies, selling lemonade, choose a charity to send the money to, even if it's a very small amount. But with all the money being donated, the question of accountability comes up. And Nick from Cliffside Park in New Jersey says that while we should all donate as much as we can,
it has to be in the context of some kind of military or policing power that just overrides the local, quote, authorities and makes sure that none of this aid is ripped off or diverted by the rich and the powerful, because they don't really care about the poor there. They never have.
Well, the motivations for the relief effort and the kinds of money going to Haiti is one story you're responding to, but also we're interested in the media's coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake in Haiti, the images, the stories, specifically the language of that coverage, and what we're observing. Is it looting or is it simply survival? One caller, Larry, thinks the difference is pretty black and white.
Taking food and medical supplies is survival. Taking TV sets and DVD players is looting. Simple.
Valerie says that the lines are a little more blurry than that, though.
The goods that are in these buildings are no good to anyone because the goods are going to be crushed with the rest of the building, so it's better useful for them to have it, and I don't call it looting. I call it getting what you need when you have no other resource.
And this came to us from our website, where you can post your comments at thetakeaway.org. The police should be helping the people, not shooting them. People ran from their homes without money or possessions, nothing. Who began calling attempts to survive looting?
And if you could sell a television for food, is that looting? It's an interesting issue. The real looting is going on by the people who are not distributing the relief goods at the airport, one person writes. All these great brains can't figure out a way to get relief packages to the people. People are giving to help without food and water right now, not to rebuild the same old as before. What do you think about what's happening in Haiti? You know how to reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, since the earthquake in Haiti, Americans have been flooded with images of the destruction and human devastation.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, provocative images from Haiti, in context or out of context. What does the media do well or poorly in a situation like this? We're going to discuss that in just a moment. Right now, let's check out the top stories at 30 minutes after the hour. It was a week ago today when the ground shook in Haiti. The European Commission now estimates there are 200,000 dead and another 1.5 million homeless. Survivors are streaming out of the capital of Port-au-Prince, and those who stay are facing increasing desperation. And they're hearing sounds like this. Haitian police chasing away a crowd that was breaking into a store in Port-au-Prince. Rear Admiral Mike Rogers, the director of intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says aid distribution is still possible, though.
We want to keep doing faster and do more, but there's nothing in the security environment right now that is significantly inhibiting our ability to execute those missions.
Broadening the relief effort, a group of international creditors is calling this morning for nations owed money by Haiti to cancel their debts.
Here at home, the polls are open in Massachusetts, where Democrat Martha Coakley is running neck and neck with Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. The health care bill may hang in the balance because Democrats need that seat to avoid a filibuster in the Senate. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, says Democrats are scrambling for a way to salvage their hard-fought health care package. In case Brown wins,
Democrats have now been hatching a plan that's been confirmed to me that what they may have to do instead of negotiating a health care bill is simply have the House pass the Senate bill.
If that happens, President Obama could sign it into law without another Senate vote needed. Two big business stories this morning. Japan Airlines, the biggest airline in Asia, filed for bankruptcy this morning. And Cadbury, the British candy maker, has accepted Kraft's offer. Worth nearly $19 billion, potentially creating the world's largest maker of chocolate and candy. Those are some of the news stories we're watching for you this morning.
Think of the language of the coverage of the disaster in Haiti. Words like desperation, lawlessness, violence, charged words like looting. But what about, hey, what would you do if you were in the same situation? Listen.
What about the fact that if it's your child or your mother, what would you do? Wouldn't you go in and grab water or diapers? They say looting. They don't even describe the context. They don't even describe if a person walked out with a few things they really needed or if they just ravaged a store.
You can register your comment at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. Our listener raises an important issue. It's an issue of language and also the images that are coming out of this 24-hour news cycle. Images also on the front page of newspapers all over the United States. Listen to this. Wolf Blitzer here is talking about some video he's about to show. And it's always seemed to me that when a news anchor says, this is graphic, this is a graphic image here, that maybe they actually want you to actually see the video. Listen to this.
Earlier today, CNN's crews witnessed the looting of a store in Port-au-Prince. Young men, many of them armed, took boxes of candles, then sold them on the street. The video we're going to be showing you is very graphic. Young people perhaps shouldn't see this video.
It's from CNN, of course. Do they really not want you to see the video? And does a picture of an event where a store is being ravaged by people in Haiti, does it represent simply one image out of context? Or is it representative of what you're likely to conclude as a trend throughout the country? Here to talk about the coverage and the difficulties and pitfalls of covering a disaster like the earthquake in Haiti is Natalie Hopkinson, media and culture critic for The Root. She joins us from her home here in Washington. Good morning, Natalie.
Good morning.
And Philip Kennicott is Washington Post culture critic, also on the line from his home in D.C. Philip, good morning.
Good morning.
In general, Natalie and Philip, let's begin with how would you assess the coverage and what sort of pitfalls have we embraced or avoided in your view of what's gone on in the past week? Natalie?
Well, I have to say I agree with the caller about the looting issue because it has become a very charged, value-laden description. And, the sheer number of images that are coming out have an impact on viewers that, we probably are only beginning to understand. And I think that in Philip's excellent essay in the Post about the media images, some of the standards that usually accompany what kinds of images are allowed to be published have been loosened. And, and I do wonder about what the impact of that is.
Philip, I sometimes sense that the media follows a certain kind of script. In the beginning, it's what did it look like? Then it's the survivor stories. And then finally, it becomes the focus on security. And in each case, it's a distortion of what's actually going on. What's your impression?
Well, I think you're right with that. In the very beginning, I was struck by how graphic the first images coming out were. And that's not just the photographers in the field. That's a series of decisions that are made up and down the chain of a news organization. And it did seem to me as if, for some reason, with Haiti, the standards were changing for what newspapers in particular were willing to show. I think as time goes on, the coverage only gets in many ways worse and worse, especially as you see the large sort of television and cable news organizations there, because they look for very, very well-patterned narratives. They look for survival stories, and they look for social violence stories, and they tend to find them because all of that is happening.
Right.
But I trust the coverage in a way less and less the longer the larger news organizations are there.
That's interesting. And even the language is distorted here. I mean, Natalie Hopkinson, suddenly there's lawlessness. Well, there's no sudden lawlessness in a place like Haiti. They've been struggling with lawlessness for generations. And secondly, suddenly there's violence. Isn't an earthquake violence, Natalie?
It very much is violent. And, lawlessness, I mean, the government buildings have been demolished. So, there would be a little bit of a challenge with the law. There are police officers who don't even have uniforms to put on. Many of them are searching for their family, and it is very much a struggle for survival. And, if you call that lawless, it really does conjure up a lot in many viewers who are used to seeing images out of the developing world. It connotes that they're behaving less than honorably, and, in fact, people are just trying to survive.
Natalie Hopkinson is media and culture critic for The Root, and Philip Kennicott is Washington Post culture critic. You're both under the same media umbrella, working for essentially the same organization. How has the rapidly changing media environment, Philip Kennicott, changed the narrative for this disaster, do you think?
Well, for one, with the Internet, of course, we can really find the images we're looking for, no matter how graphic or tame they are. The other is competition.
Let's stop there. That's an interesting point. So people can surf for dead bodies.
Right. So I don't think that you know, the old gatekeeping function obviously has changed a lot. People will look for and find almost anything out there. So the self-censoring that the media used to practice isn't really nearly as enforced as it was.
Oh, that's a really interesting point. How do you think that affects the priorities of network organizations who bring enormous amounts of resources into a place like Haiti to cover it before we go?
Well, I sense, looking at the television footage, that they are looking for more dramatic. They are inserting their anchors into the events as participants to give it kind of more dramatic life. I think they're crossing boundaries that we haven't really seen, boundaries that were suggested by Katrina, but are really, you know, kind of a new way of approaching this is taking form now.
Well, lots to think about there. Philip Kennicott is the Washington Post culture critic, and Natalie Hopkinson, media and culture critic for The Root, both talking about coverage of the Haitian disaster. And, you know, we needn't just rely on two culture critics or media critics. We want to get you involved in all this. Who have you seen injecting themselves into the narrative of the Haitian disaster, and does it help you or hurt you in understanding the story? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can go to our website at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we're going to take a different look at Haiti's aftermath through the musical voices of Haiti. It has a diverse heritage and vibrant culture expressed through its music. Stay tuned for that. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry in Washington.
And I'm Miles O'Brien in New York, in for Celeste Headlee this week. In Connecticut, a horrific triple murder of a family is turning into a test of the death penalty. Only the father of this family, Dr. William Pettit, survived. His wife and two daughters were brutally murdered in one of the most savage crimes in state history. Joining us is Colin McEnroe, Hartford Current columnist and host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Colin, good to have you with us. How has this affected people in Connecticut?
Well, I mean, it's almost as though it's the only murder that has taken place in Connecticut in the last two or three years. I mean, there are maybe about 30 murders in Hartford every year. I can pretty well guarantee you the average person doesn't know the name of any of the victims or the circumstances of the crime. People tend to know quite a bit about the Pettit murders.
All right. Now, this is factored into kind of an ongoing debate in Connecticut about the death penalty. Tell us about that.
Well, in Connecticut, we're a death penalty state. We had the first execution in 45 years in New England in 2005, the execution of Michael Ross. We have 11 men on death row right now. But on the other hand, the legislature, even kind of in the teeth of the outrage over the Pettit murders, the legislature voted last year to abolish the death penalty, and the governor vetoed that bill, citing pretty much only the Pettit case as her reason.
So is it speculation? I know, but if it weren't for this case, do you think that perhaps the death penalty might have been rescinded there?
I don't know. I'd have to be able to look into the mind of M. Jody Rell, our governor, and I've never been very successful at doing that. She might have vetoed the bill anyway, but certainly this provides a dramatic reason for vetoing a bill like that.
Dr. William Pettit, the sole survivor of this horrific attack at their home in Connecticut, what's his role in this debate?
He's become very, very public. He's, you know, understandably interested in vengeance. He is an advocate of the death penalty. He was furious, publicly furious, at the legislature for passing abolition of the death penalty. He and his sister now lead a sort of a grassroots organization supporting the Three Strikes and You're Out law.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because it does get into issues of parole and recidivism and letting criminals out in the street. Has that gotten a lot of talk in Connecticut?
Yes and no. I mean, at the time, in 2007, there was a call for, there were obviously huge defects in the system, and people felt that, you know, there was something terribly wrong with the criminal justice system. There was a huge outcry for an overhaul. Now, simultaneously with jury selection, we actually are scheduled to have this week, I think, one of the first reports on the, you know, sludgy bureaucratic blue ribbon task force that's supposed to be figuring all this stuff out. The truth is almost none of the reforms have been accomplished in the last 2 years, partly, of course, because of the budget crunch. Like every other state around here, Connecticut has no money to do any of the things that were so urgently needed to be done in 2007. So there was a lot of noise, but not a whole lot of action.
Colin McEnroe, Hartford Current columnist, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks for your time.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry down here in Washington, D.C., and Miles O'Brien is up in New York for Celeste Headlee, who's on vacation this week. Coming up, we're going to look at Haiti's diverse heritage and vibrant culture through its music, the aftermath of the earthquake through the diverse and rich music of Haiti. Marlon Malaya joins us, and anthropology and religion professor Elizabeth McAllister will be with us in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Snowing in Massachusetts as people head out to vote in the race for Ted Kennedy's Senate seat. The race between Republican Scott Brown and Democrat Martha Coakley is close. In the past few days, Brown urged his constituents to head to the polls.
Make sure that you and you and you and you and you and even you guys filming, make sure you get out to vote.
They're counting votes on the Democratic side as well. President Obama has thrown his support to Democrat Martha Coakley.
On all the fights that matter to middle-class families across this Commonwealth, who is going to be on your side?
A Republican win would eliminate the Democrats' 60-seat majority in the Senate and put health care legislation potentially at risk. Our Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is analyzing the special Senate election as it unfolds. Go to thetakeaway.org.
Moving to Haiti now, the World Food Program is planning a tent camp just outside the capital for 100,000 people who have lost their homes. The European Commission estimates 1.5 million people were made homeless as a result of that earthquake a week ago. Finally, there's been angry reaction from Britain's Cadbury family. This after news the British chocolate maker had accepted a takeover bid from the American food giant Kraft. Speaking to our partner, the BBC, this morning, the great-great-granddaughter of Cadbury's founder, Felicity Loden, urged shareholders to reject the takeover.
I don't think we should give up at all. We can't sell out to a plastic cheese company. So it's a horror story.
Not so sweet there. After all-night negotiations, the management of Cadbury accepted an offer of around $19 billion from Kraft. Those are some of the news stories we're watching for you this morning.
So listen to that music, Miles. You feel that energy?
I do.
Well, there's also poignance. The name of this tune, Rebuild the House. Listen. That's Kampa music. Kampa music. Rebati Kela, which is the name of that song, which means rebuild the house. It's a poignant song this week in Haiti. One of the many voices of music in Haiti that both reflects and aids in communicating the terrible tragedy of the people of Haiti. Here to talk about it for the next segment in this hour is Elizabeth McAllister, who's a professor of religion at Wesleyan and author of the book Rara Vodou, Power and Performance in Haiti and Its Diaspora. She joins us from Middletown, Connecticut. Do I have that right on the title of your book, Elizabeth?
Yes, thanks. Hi, everybody. And can I just say I'd like to send my condolences out to everybody who lost people in Haiti, Haitian families, and also organizations who lost people on the ground. Just terribly sorry.
And that's an enormous audience that that message goes out to. Well said. Marlon Rayo Mayaya, rapper in New York, is a second-generation Haitian. I suspect you would have some of the same message to send out as well, right, Marlon?
Definitely. As I've personally lost, you know, some relatives due to the situation back home, so I definitely say rest in peace. May their souls rest in peace, and, you know, all my condolences.
How important is music in that process of condolence, in grief, in understanding the experience of Haiti right now and down through history? Elizabeth McAllister, using this latest song that we just played as an example, how important is it?
Well, it's crucial. People in the streets right now have absolutely nothing except the breath in their lungs. They've had their houses crushed, their families killed, their belongings evaporated, and they have no water, which is the really most intense and frightening thing. And what we're hearing from the streets is that what they are doing is that they are gathering together and singing. And they're singing hymns. They're singing spiritual songs. They're singing all the hymns they know, which generally are about praising God and asking for mercy. And that's the reaction, and that's not just in isolated pockets or just among churches. That seems to be the general mass reaction of the citizenry in Port-au-Prince, and apparently at dusk, is when the lights go down. I mean, the sunlight goes down. Things kind of quiet down on the streets, and then all the journalists and all my friends on the ground are tweeting or emailing, you know, we're starting to hear the singing now. So music is clearly, like, basically the only brass ring that they have to hang on to right now.
You say brass ring. We're going to talk about the components of Haitian music in just a moment, but let's listen to this next cut. It's called the Tribulacion. It describes, first of all, a different type of music and a different type of solidarity there in Port-au-Prince. Listen. Elizabeth McAllister, first of all, what are they saying in that song? And, it's a very different instrumentation from the compa music that we heard at the beginning.
From what I hear, that sounds like Jean-Daniel Beaubrun. That sounds like maybe it's a song from Boukman Experience. And they're a band influenced largely by voodoo music mixed with rock. But in that particular track, they also reveal their underlying Protestant influence. That was modeled more on a Protestant hymn, believe it or not. And it's saying, you know, tribulation, tribulation, that's what we're undergoing right now.
Interesting. And, you know, you've got a mix of African rhythms, you've got French influence, a lot of European instruments in a very, very African kind of mix. Marlon Malaya, what are the tools you use to create your sound?
Well, definitely the African influence is there. I mean, the type of music that I do is hip-hop. And if you do your history on hip-hop, like me, myself, I'm an MC. And if you do the research on what an MC is, they get their vernacular or whatever you want to call it, or, you know, however they kick their stuff through something that's originated in West Africa. You know, it was a person called the Griot. And the Griot was a person that was either a praise singer or a wandering musician or a poet. You know, these guys were considered like the repository of, you know, of oral tradition. So I'm just carrying that on, you know, on top of rhythm. You know what I mean?
And you come by it rightly. Your grandfather played in Brooklyn with Tito Puente. Your father toured in a compa band. Let's listen to this song, Sentiment, right now, and I want to hear your response to it, Marlon.
Okay.
All right, so, that's an important song using elements from the past. How do you use that to get to the sort of present tense that your music is about?
Well, particularly that part we're listening to right now, there's a little bit of funk in it, which is also comprised of hip, which is also what hip-hop is comprised of. So it's all the blending of styles and the genres together that make the sound of hip-hop and also make the sound of compa. Like, compa music was also influenced by the Afro-Cuban sound. That's where you get the African drums from, the cymbals, and then you hear the claves and the keys, you know, according to, you know what I mean, the Latin music scene. So it all combines with everything we're doing, man. But this song in particular is so important because of the lyrics. What are they saying in that song? And if I could, maybe just, you know, cite a couple lines from it.
Go quick.
Okay, it's saying, Haiti Cheri, like the USA has its motto and its saying, it says, God bless America. Haiti Cheri means Haiti, my baby, which is basically Haiti's, motto and mantra.
That's a great takeaway. Haiti, my baby. Marlon Rayo Mayala, rapper in New York, second generation Haitian, helping us to hear through the window of Haitian music this hour. And Elizabeth McAllister, a professor of religion at Wesley and an author of the book Rara Voodoo, Power and Performance in Haiti and its Diaspora. Thanks to both of you. I'm dancing, Miles.
Yeah, me too. All day we've been examining the language in the media coverage of the aftermath of last week's earthquake as well. asking you when looting is simply is looting, and what do people have to do in order to survive? This takeaway comes from Elaine in Brooklyn.
I think it's just an internalized lack of empathy for people who are going through something that if it were a different race, those words would never, ever, ever be used. You wouldn't use that word to talk about people in Israel or someone in Europe if they are getting water out of a store because there hasn't been any relief efforts in over 5 days and it's based upon survival.
I'm Miles O'Brien.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.